Good evening. Still light outside. Something? Wow. We have a new face tonight. You've been here before? I thought I remembered you from some time. Let's do introductions around. We had a very good sit on Saturday. It was a cold day. Thunderstorms were threatened. It was gray. The wind was blowing. And Connie had a fire going in one of the rooms, a cozy room, where the Doksan was. So the Doksan chairs are right in front of the little wood-burning stove, and I kept stoking it all morning as we people came and went. And then the sitting room was the same one we used last year, with lots of heat in it. It was warm and toasty. And then we had a feast, as usual, because Connie made wonderful food, and then people brought more. So we ate inside, of course. But it was totally different from what we did last year, in the way that it wasn't sunshine and all the green grass and the bunny rabbits running through the field. It was like winter, and a very nice, cozy way to sit for a whole day. So I hope we can do it again. I told them that I thought Coben would have been very, very happy to see us up there because it was just his kind of place. What he loved most was sitting around a campfire in the woods somewhere. And this was kind of like that. A little more civilized than that, but it's the same kind of feeling of being in connection with nature as well as in connection with meditation. That they're all about the same. So we are in the middle of, well, not even quite the middle. We're reading and discussing the Diamond Sutra. Do you know that one, Deirdre? It's a very very famous and ancient one of the sutras that every Mahayana person finds out about eventually, and it becomes a kind of central part, just like the Heart Sutra that we chanted. It's another aspect of the Heart Sutra. So it's even more mysterious in the Heart Sutra in a way, so it's a challenge, but a kind of challenge that I think is extremely nourishing for all of us. So, yes, it's chapter 7, isn't it? Yeah, it's 7. Who would like to read it? It's a very short one. And then the commentary is very long. Me too, you want to read it?
Sure. Once again, the Buddha asked the Venerable Subhuti, "What do you think, Subhuti? Did the Tathagata realize any such dharma as unexcelled, perfect enlightenment?" And does the Tathagata teach any such dharma? The Venerable Subhuti thereupon answered, Bhagavan, as I understand the meaning of what the Buddha says, the Tathagata did not realize any such dharma as unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Nor does the Tathagata teach such a dharma. And why? Because this dharma realized and taught by the Tathagata is incomprehensible and inexpressible, and neither a dharma nor no dharma. And why? Because sages arise from what is uncreated.
So what Subhuti is doing here is expressing his understanding, which is the Hinayana aspect, the basic original understanding that that wisdom comes from emptiness. But he hasn't got what Buddha is trying to explain to him, is that even emptiness is empty. And so what the Tathagata teaches is something that he doesn't yet understand. So this chapter and the next chapter are about the teaching of Buddha, trying to explain to Subhuti the slight difference in what he knows and what Buddha is bringing to him to know. So Red Pine says about this, the Buddha knows that Subhuti has not yet grasped this teaching, that he is still attached to the no dharma of no dharmas, emptiness. It's very easy to get attached to emptiness. It's easy to live in a kind of dream world. And often people pass through that dream world on their way in part of their way-seeking. Hence, Red Pine says, hence he raises the subject of dharmas again, this time focusing on the dharma among dharmas, unexcelled perfect enlightenment, the realization of which is experienced by a Buddha's reward body, and the teaching of which is manifested by a Buddha's apparition body, but which is itself a Buddha's true body, his dharma body. That enlightenment actually is about the body, the kayas they're called, dharmakaya, nirmanakaya. So the Hinayana doctrine of emptiness says that enlightenment is beyond expression. It's beyond the realm of conception at all. You can't think enlightenment. But Subhuti even is saying that if it's empty, such a dharma is necessarily empty, but it's maybe not empty also. For the Buddha has realized enlightenment, and the Buddha does teach. So there must be something about that that is different from what he thought he knew. If everything is empty, then there's no place for form. And there can't be emptiness without form, can there? Any more than there can be form without emptiness. So the Buddha is focusing on the Bodhisattva way, the Hinayana way, the achievement of the arhat is different from the bodhisattva way. The bodhisattva way is to actually help people. And the arhat way is to help oneself. It's to focus completely on practicing and completely on liberating oneself. So that you achieve nirvana and then your work is done. The bodhisattva, on the other hand, is involved, completely involved with life, with all the forms of life. And so Red Pine says, the Buddha is concerned that the goal of Buddhahood might become another source of attachment, because that's what happens with the arhats, become attached to the whole idea of enlightening oneself. And it just becomes one more grasping. And that's why he asked Subhuti about the nature of enlightenment. What do you think, Subhuti? Did the Tathagata realize any such dharma as unexcelled perfect enlightenment? And does the Tathagata teach any such dharma? And of course, Subhuti would say right away, well, no, he didn't. But Buddha is saying, he will be saying next week that there's something beyond what you have understood about this. So there's a teaching about sages. That's where the sages sages arise from what is uncreated. Red Pine says this term, sages, they apply to those dharmas that are self-existent and not subject to creation or destruction. Of course, the original teaching is that everything falls apart. Everything is created and falls apart. It's a continual process. But in this understanding, there are three things that are never destroyed or created: nirvana and space and a Buddha's Dharma body. So this is what Subhuti is trying to explain. He thinks that enlightenment is another one of these uncreated dharmas, like space. It's out there somewhere. But Red Pine says he has not yet grasped the emptiness of emptiness, which is why this sutra does not end here. He has to remain in ignorance so that it can continue. Nor does the Buddha praise him as he does later in the sutra, but encourages him in the next chapter to look beyond the uncreated. What's beyond nirvana? Vasubandhu said, dharmas and no dharmas, and those that are not no dharmas, are taught according to the meaning of reality. And why is the focus on teaching and not on realization? Because teaching is the manifestation of realization. So realization, enlightenment, is not some spaced out experience. It's the actual experience of encountering the Dharma, wrestling with it, expressing it, being the expression of it. And yet, an old fellow named Chi Fo said, teachings are only teachings. None of them is real. The Buddha tells us there is no teaching and that we should break through the barrier of words. So that's bringing up the other side. And it's our constant question, how is it that we talk so much about this? And yet, we have to talk about this, even though it's the words just get in the way. Sometimes the words don't. Sometimes the words actually are able to point toward the wordless, the unspeakable, unapproachable. But it's well to remember that words are a barrier. And why we value silence so much. So, it's a teeny little chapter, but it's crucial, especially around the bodies of Buddha, because it continues to talk about that all the way through. The Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya. And I thought I wrote down for you what those exactly are, but I don't see it. Dharmakaya is the the unexcelled, perfect, complete, whole essence of everything, you could say. The body of the universe, or the body of the many universes, the ultimate. And Sambhogakaya is the enjoyment body, or the joyful body. The expression of the Dharmakaya comes as joy and is lived as Nirmanakaya, as the Buddha. So there are many Nirmanakayas. In terms of Zazen, we're all Nirmanakaya. And it's all one body, really. We often, at least used to talk about the earth as a living body. I talked about the earth as she, Mother Earth. And had a sense of how the earth is living and breathing. Even though it's so huge, still. But Dharmakaya is even bigger than that. An old friend sent me an email this afternoon, which was a picture of the earth in relation to a part of the universe. It's just a picture like this. But the earth is like a dot, a tiny, tiny dot with millions and jillions of stuff all around it. And it's just one little part of the universe that's being shown. and he calls it the blue dot. It's very, very awesome. Just this tiny, tiny blue dot in the middle of who knows what. We don't even know what we're in the middle of. And all of that is Dharmakaya, the body of Buddha. If we're a body, then our life is a body, then the life around us is all a body, and we're all connected. We're all breathing together. Are there questions? Wendy?
Yes, Angie, what is the translation of Sam?
Enjoyment is one of them.
So that is the translation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are other ways of saying it, but I can't remember them at the moment. Sometimes they use the metaphor of the sun. That Dharmakaya is like the sun, a source of all light, and Sambhogakaya is the sunlight itself, and Nirmanakaya is what comes as a result of the light, the life itself that is comes from the source. Samia?
This is a crazy question. So if Buddha is in it, we're like, we do this big book about it, you know, we sit and we really believe in it. I mean, and we're all Buddhas. But why do we keep referring to the Buddha? Are there, you know, it's like this one teaching, this is it.
Yeah.
Aren't there others and others and zillions of others?
There are. Yeah.
But why do we keep doing the same thing over and over?
What is the same thing we do?
I don't know. I mean this. We sit
and
do the same thing.
Well,
I mean, I'm always worried that I'm missing something.
You think there's something in this, or there's something out there that you're missing?
Both. Because you're always warning us, you know? Mm. Don't get attached to this. But yet we are sitting here and studying it over and over.
Well, are you torturing yourself about it?
No, I don't think so. It's just, you know, maybe thinking too much. Just I'm putting it out there in case somebody else is crazy like me to admit.
Well, it's a good question. It's everybody's question, really. And I'm not sure we quite know. We come back to sit. Once we have sat. And I always say, I think anyone who comes to sit in the first place is already enlightened. So we've all had experiences that are hard to talk about and yet require some kind of action. And it's a repetitive action because we keep changing all the time. And it's like our life itself. It's like we get up and make breakfast every morning. We sit down and sit zazen every morning because it's our life. Once we realize how it tastes and it smells, then that's part of the realization, is the sitting part, the expression of it part. But nobody's making us do this. And we can quit any time we want. You know, sometimes I tease people, go ahead, walk out the door. It's hard to walk out the door. But it's hard to know exactly what it is. And it's not an attachment. I mean, it can become an attachment. It can become a replacement for a meaningful life. Just take zazen and be the whole of do that and nothing else. And identify with oneself with it. And that's a mistake. It shouldn't be something special and extra. It's just who we are. And in terms of Buddhism, there are many, many, many Buddhas in the old stories. And when we make a list of all the Buddhas, and we start out with 7 Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, just to say this Shakyamuni Buddha wasn't the first one. And we don't know who the other ones were, but it goes way back. I just saw the movie about the caves in France, in the Ardèche. They're 30,000 years old or something. No, they can't be that old. Very, very old. The oldest ones that they have found.
Is that the 3D movie?
Yes.
By Werner Herzog?
By Herzog. It's incredible.
What is it called?
Something about caves.
Okay.
Dream of caves or something like that. Cave of Dreams, it could be. It's newly discovered in the last 2 years, and it's very hard to get into, and nobody goes there because they're afraid it will be destroyed. But they allowed Herzog to go in and film all the things that have been painted on the walls. And they are exquisite, beautiful, powerful animals. Tigers and lions and horses, a whole little team of horses. Very, very brilliantly done. They're as good as anything you would see today, better. And there's no sign that anybody lived in there. Bears lived in there, and they have all kinds of signs of bears, scratchings on the wall, and skulls and bones, big skulls of those cave bears that are extinct now. But there's no sign of human living there. No little debris, no corn stalks or anything like that. And they think it was just a place of worship. It was some kind of powerful temple that they created. And of course they didn't have light except for torches. So it was all done by torchlight and just charcoal, just the burnt end of a stick. But the way they could put a line in and make an animal alive on the wall of a stone wall of a cave and express something of enlightenment is quite remarkable. I don't have a watch tonight, so I don't know what the time is. I guess I do know what time it is. Well, we'll go on to number 8 tomorrow. Tuesday, next Tuesday.